the one to say I was so lucky to come here with PR. If you're wanting a workforce to come into this country to do jobs that you can't find people to do, people should be allowed to come into this country with PR, with all the safety and access to labor rights and the ability to settle their children with no hardship.
There's a highlight from a new episode of The Breach Show. Listen to the rest of the interview wherever you get your podcasts and at harbingermedianetwork.com. And find more journalism for transformation at breachmedia.ca. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. Coming up next. Broadcasting since 2022, muckraking Edmonton-based independent journalist Jeremy Appel's The Orchard Cast harvests thoughtful, in-depth interviews with activists, academics, and others every week, like in this conversation with Jacobin's Luke Savage discussing the Carney Doctrine. Now, here's Jeremy Appel.
Yeah, I think we both expected him to reverse a lot of the meager progress Trudeau made, not stand up to the United States to the extent that he said he would, but it seems to me that it's been a lot worse than I expected. And I'm wondering what your perspective on that is. Did you expect Carney to cave as quickly and as as he has thus far?
Yes and no. I mean, I think in some ways, the direction of the government, broadly speaking, doesn't surprise me because, you know, the signals, as you said, were there very early. As soon as you hear, a banker talking about how we need to spend less and invest more, I mean, it's very clear what you know. It's very clear what that means. Even if as a piece of political rhetoric, it's very much a like having your cake and eating it too, which is why he phrases it like that. But I think that the speed at which and the kind of rapidity with which the Carney government has abandoned, I think really the two things that, broadly speaking, it gave it its mandate. One, allowed it to win the election and have this kind of spectacular electoral recovery for the Liberal Party. One was this promise to stand up to Donald Trump. And in the early months of this year, we saw all of these reciprocal tariffs, all of these counter tariffs. We saw, Doug Ford threatening to switch off the lights in upstate New York. Things that, honestly, at the time anyway, I mean, this isn't that long ago, but this felt to me like... if one kind of mainstream centrist and center right politicians are talking this way and when they're thinking this way, these are the kinds of moments that often often contain a lot of progressive potential. And they're often kind of a precursor to something else. That's not what Carney's been doing with Trump at all. In fact, Canada, I think, as of the middle of last month, about 4 weeks ago, has agreed not to do any more reciprocal tariffs. And all of these climb downs, it's ostensibly, it's 24-dimensional chess or whatever. But even on its own terms, this has been a failure, right? Because they don't have a deal. So that's the first thing. And the second thing, really was, I think, rhetorically anyway, a pretty explicit alignment with the idea of activist government. I think a lot of people thought they were basically voting for something kind of social democratic in Mark Carney. What they heard in the, two slogans that he made quite liberal use of during the election campaign. I mean, people may have heard different things, but I don't think they heard, a sweeping program of austerity and cuts in he said Canadians need to become masters in our own house, which, if you know anything about the history of Canada, the history of Quebec in the 1960s, that's a very pregnant phrase, right? This was the slogan that I believe it was the second election that the Quebec Liberal Party, which was at that time sort of the big kind of reforming and ideologically kind of social democratic party in Quebec in the 60s, you know, when they used it, they were talking about nationalizing hydroelectricity and things like that. The other phrase Carney kept using, which I think flew under the radar for most people, but just because of work I've been doing the past few years, was not lost on me, is he kept talking about how Canada needs to take control of its economic destiny. And, you know, that's a phrase my late friend Ed Broadbent used a lot. And, you know, he launched the 1980 NDP campaign on that slogan. And what he meant was, you know, a national industrial strategy. So using the federal government to actually discipline industry, discipline capital, direct the country's economic development. You know, and again, whether people recognize the precise, you know, the exact historical references there or not, I don't think anybody heard in those things, you know, a sweeping program of cuts and a bunch of capitulations to Donald Trump. So in some ways, I think the direction of the Carney government is surprising, given that they clearly had latitude to move in a different direction. They clearly had a mandate to move in a different direction. I think many people wanted them to. But in other ways, it's not surprising at all, right? Because if you look into Mark Carney, you know, he's a banker, and his books and his arguments are those, you know, they reflect a view of the world that is very enmeshed in the supposed emancipatory potential of markets and in the dangers of reining them in. I guess just to include my thoughts here, I mean, he, you know, he's always been very good. And I mean, I think in some ways he is a rather slick operator. He's always been very good at kind of softening the rhetoric of, you know, the kind of Davos sect from whence he comes, of, you know, really kind of blunting the edges of pro-market rhetoric and making it sound like something else. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot more that could be said here, but I'll let you come back in.
Yeah, no, but that I think lines up nicely with what I wanted to ask you next, which is his book that you read. You wrote a piece about it for The Baffler. And this book's called Values. And my understanding of it, someone who hasn't read it but has read about it, is that he's framing his argument as, yes, markets are great. They do wonderful things, right? Of course, he is a banker. But also, we need to have values that exist outside the market, right? And I'm wondering how he sort of squares that circle in the book, or whether he does.
Yes, I mean, if people haven't seen the book, you know, the title, it's Values, but like the S is in brackets, and you know, the implication is sort of like you have value in the market sense on the one hand, you know, economic value. You know, that's kind of the stand-in for capital. Then you have values, which are like those nice things that, you know, exist outside of the marketplace, and it's kind of, you know, inequalities and it's competition and all the rest of it. And, you know, the book is, it's a very strange thing in many ways, because, you know, Carney, I don't want to give him too much credit, but he has a certain literacy around economic and philosophical concepts that I think is, I mean, again, one doesn't want to exaggerate it. It's like, I'm not that impressed that, you know, the difference between like what Adam Smith thought about a rudimentary concept and what like David Ricardo or Karl Marx thought about the same concept. But nonetheless, he, you know, displays a much greater literacy about those sorts of things than somebody like Justin Trudeau would, right? Justin Trudeau, you know, didn't come to politics this way. He was, you know, he believes fundamentally many of the same things Carney does, but, you know, the route he took to them was just that this was the received wisdom of kind of the, you know, people around him, and he didn't really think about it too much. Carney's not like that. Carney is somebody who, you know, went to elite institutions and kind of imbibed their ideas and their kind of ideological frameworks. And so has a certain command of these things that somebody like a Trudeau would not have. And, you know, if you don't read this book carefully, And it's easy not to, because particularly in the middle sections, when it gets away from philosophy, and it's more just, you know, there's sections about the COVID pandemic, the financial crisis, these sorts of things. It can be very dense. It can be very granular. It's not particularly exciting to read, and it's not as interesting to read as the first third. But again, if you get through that, you know, if you kind of wade through that swamp and reach the end, you know, you'll see that he's thanking Michael Bloomberg and Christine Lagarde and all these kinds of people. But, you know, only if you do that and you read carefully will you really notice that there are no real prescriptions in this book that are specific enough to yield a view of markets that's actually critical. What Carney wants is for market actors, and he often refers to, like, the reader, like he'll refer to individuals and their firms, like as if that is kind of the stand-in for the average reader. It's like, I don't know about you, that's not how I kind of refer to, you know, my friends or acquaintances or professional colleagues, but that's who Carney is fundamentally addressing in his book. And he basically wants these sorts of people to, be a bit more compassionate in how they think. You know, he wants them to, you know, if you run a company, big or small, you know, look into its carbon footprint, see what you can do about that, you know, and scale that up to kind of global and multinational institutions. Let's have summits where we pass non-binding resolutions and that sort of thing. That's how Carney has spent a lot of his professional career. And that's how he thinks, that's his conception of what politics is. So if you want to say anything interesting about this book, if there's anything interesting to be said about it, it's that Carney is not unaware that there are things about markets that are imperfect, but having and kind of fundamentally amoral, but having reached that understanding, he's not willing to kind of grapple with any more serious criticisms of them or really look to any world that tries to kind of fundamentally rein them in, let alone move beyond them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, I think it was an error on the part of the publisher not to spell values with a dollar sign instead of the brackets. But I guess, yeah, it seems like and based on, you know, what you've written about this book, is Carney is fundamentally making a neoliberal argument in which the market exists outside of the political realm, right? That we have this market that is sort of this force of nature. I think you've done a great job of describing, like, how markets and, like, business leaders can, you know, sort of reflect their values through their enterprises. But what government and the view that Carney expressed in values?
I mean, I think this speaks to the other thing that's defined Mark Carney's career, which is that he's been somebody very close to kind of the nexus of power in the nexus, I suppose, connecting financial power and state power in his capacities as governor of the Bank of Canada and governor of the Bank of England. And I think from that, he has a fundamentally technocratic view of government and of the role of the state. He thinks that political problems are, they're technical problems in the same way that, as, you know, a central banker, he believed that, you know, interest rates, those are kind of separate from politics. You know, what you need is a skilled technician, someone like himself, who, I don't know what you do. You go and meditate in the foothills of Kilimanjaro for a few weeks.
Go to Burning Man.
Yeah, you go to Burning Man, and I don't know, when you see the purple smoke, to mix my metaphors, you got to go pull the lever that makes the interest rate go up or down by 0.2 or 3%. You know, it's fundamentally he sees governance, I think, as an enterprise of elite technicians, sure, they go to electorates every few years and they ask for permission or assent to kind of keep governing. But I think, you know, when you have a fundamentally elitist view of politics like this, I think you regard that process as kind of like secondary or obligatory. You know, that's the bread and circuses for the people that don't know about interest rates and derivatives and bond markets and all the other really fascinating things that you know about. And so I think that's why Carney had no problem, you know, embracing the rhetoric of the quiet revolution or stealing slogans from Ed Broadbent, and then not, you know, following through on them. I think kind of, you know, governing and campaigning are completely, in some ways, completely distinct things to him. And so I don't think he particularly cares about the obvious contradictions there.
That was an excerpt from the new episode of The Orchard Cast. Find the show archives at readtheorchard.com, at harbingermedianetwork.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. And finally, since launching in Toronto in 2006, Green Majorities become Canada's longest-running weekly environmental news hour, helping transform the environmental movement into a social justice-oriented push for a more sustainable society. On this highlight from a recent episode, hosts Stefan and David Hostetter and Lauren Latour open the show talking about wildfires, drought, autocracy, and Canada's gaslighting around Indigenous relations. Now, here's the show.
And this is the pride of the nation, the Green Majority, the longest-running environmental news hour in this nation. Talk radio, the best thing that happened to the 21st century, all over again. And we are on CIUT 89.5 FM, or your local community radio station, Harbinger Media Network podcast application. We have Stefan, Christian, Irwin Host that are back in the house.
How you doing?
And we have Lauren Elizabeth Core Latour still within the house.
Still within the house. The call's coming from within the building. I'm trapped, etc.
And Stefan will be interviewing an excellent individual, Gordon Kottich, of what's his podcast? Cited Podcast. Mm-hmm. Harbinger Media Network. And you guys, what are you guys going to be discussing?
His most recent series that's coming out, actually should be out now when this show airs. Oh no, sorry, it comes out next week. The trailer is out now. Is a 5 or 6 part series about different sort of green visions for the world, and he sort of goes back to like thinkers in the 1960s and 50s and 60s and 70s, and sort of follows their thinking through and to now. And discusses sort of their versions of what they thought might be utopia, and sort of the ways that is not really a utopia, or the ways it hasn't really worked out. And yeah, it's called Green Dreams. So it's all about different environmental thinkers and sort of how it plays out in the world.
Green Dreams, Cited Podcast. Stay tuned. And before that, we are going to slip gracefully in to some climate news. So first, we appear to have had our second worst wildfire season on record here in Canada, and 1 in 7 First Nations have been impacted. Sonal Gupta for the National Observer is writing, quote, "This year's fires are occurring in regions such as Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and the Maritimes, which were where such large-scale activity has been less common historically. Many First Nations communities are overexposed and underserved. Remote fly-in communities with minimal access routes face significant risks in evacuation and recovery. The infrastructure gaps make an already dangerous situation much worse. Firefighters have been trying to save the hamlet of Fort Providence, Northwest Territories this week as a wildfire reached within 900 meters of the town. And Canada has, of course, had a severe drought this summer, with 71% of the country abnormally dry. Jordan Olmsted writes for the Canadian Press, quote, "Canada is home to 20% of the world's fresh water, but less than half of it is naturally renewed through the hydrological cycle. It's otherwise tied up in glaciers and underground aquifers or large lakes where replenishment is slow." Olmsted quotes leading hydrologist John Pomery as saying that what has stood out about this year is just how widespread those drought conditions have become. The only other year in recent memory when drought was so widespread was 2023. It's a coast-to-coast-to-coast drought, so that's quite exceptional. Pommery called the bone dry conditions in typically wet Newfoundland and Nova Scotia mind boggling. And this is, I mean, this is potentially an instance of what has been called environmental racism, where sort of we build these systems that allow environmental disasters to occur in places where the ruling majority does not live, does not think about. So we have this, we have these, many, many First Nations being impacted by these wildfires. But on the other hand, one can also imagine that the ruling class could just slip further and further away from problem areas.
Yeah. I mean, I think that is, I think, the most likely outcome that we will see over time. I mean, in California, you saw the super rich sort of start in hiring private firefighters, which had its own challenges. And then in a lot of other places, you're seeing exactly that. You're seeing sort of the wealthy being able to sell their land and move to places where they are not facing sort of consistent extreme weather. And those who can't afford to end up in these areas that are much, much more at risk. Now, of course, the double stroke of colonialism and capitalism in this particular front is that, you know, many of these First Nations are on reserves. They can't move the reserves. Like, they don't have that power. And so they are quite literally being forced to stay in these areas that are deeply, deeply unsafe. And there's not any real action and availability that the Canadian government is doing at all to address that. And so that's sort of an additional layer that doesn't exist sort of in the, you know, say, floodplains in the States and stuff like that, that have some of the other insurance questions. This is a bit more directly related to the history of colonialism.
Yeah. And I mean, I think what we started to see this summer with so many wildfires on the East Coast in like a really unprecedented way, because like, I don't like when you think drought, when you think wildfire, you're certainly not thinking of Newfoundland and the Maritime provinces. Yeah, it's wild to think about when I used to live in the Maritimes that it would ever be that dry there, this consistently for such a long period of time. But anyway, the point I was gonna make is that, like, I think as we see wildfire season and extreme situations like this pop up not only every summer, but over broader and broader and broader swaths of land. And especially as it reaches these remote communities that are not well resourced as it is, unless we do in fact see a massive federal investment in firefighting capacities, these communities are going to be lost. They're going to be wasted over time because, frankly, they're not in a financial position. Even if, and this is obviously, this is a disaster scenario, people are able to get out of these areas, they're not going to be in a financial position to rebuild or anyway, it just strikes me that we're under-resourced as it is, and as those resources are spread over a broader and broader swath of land, it's just going to become more and more apparent. The Maritimes are a region that struggle financially to begin with. It's not that these communities don't have firefighting know-how, but it's simply that they lack the resources. So we're going to have to see a huge, huge investment from the federal government in adaptive measures and firefighting capacity. And I think that's the other thing that we sort of have to accept at this point, is that, like, I think for a long time, and I know we've talked about this on this show before, but like, for the longest time, a while ago, the environmental community was kind of loath to start talking about adaptive measures because it seemed like sort of like giving up the ghost a little bit. But we're at this point now where adaptation has to be invested in just as much as mitigative measures are, because frankly, like, this is where we are right now. People are having to relocate from their homes now. Communities are being lost now. And Newfoundland is not a province that has the cash to put behind a robust firefighting effort. So the federal government needs to step up in this capacity. And I know there already has been some investment there, and I'm assuming there are plans to sort of flesh that out in the future. But I feel like I read an article at some point about somebody being like, what if this is one of these sort of like big means or avenues through which Canada can invest in climate action, is through a mass rollout campaign of water bombers or whatever. And I'm sure there's a million holes in that idea, but like, I don't know. I'm always sort of thinking about like, what are ways that we get people on board with large scale spending for climate mm-hmm. action. And like, this might be one of them, because this is a way that people can see it's like, it's so necessary and it's so immediate. And like, regardless of whether or not you think climate is the, like, climate change is the driver here, it's a problem that needs to be fixed and it needs a lot of investment. So anyway, yeah. I'll be curious to see how this conversation continues to shake out over the course of this like new parliamentary period once the feds come back to sit. Because I mean, I don't know, maybe it's naive to think it's going to be different, but it does. It's, I think everybody thought when wildfire season started getting really, really bad, maybe 5 years ago, that that would be the turning point. And I just keep thinking, maybe this is it, maybe this is it, maybe this is it. But the goalposts just keep shifting.
What's interesting also is that, you know, investing in actually getting these fires out more quickly does actually keep carbon in trapped in the trees themselves. And so there is a way in which actually really investing in rapid response and being able to keep these trees and these ecosystems from burning to the extent they are, they can and do, is obviously an adaptation method, but it is also mitigation, you know, from that, that front. And the other thing I'll say before Dave goes to the next wildfire story, because we have more than one, is it's interesting to look at the difference between what's happening in Spain right now.
There's a highlight from a new episode of Green Majority Radio. Find new episodes every week at greenmajority.ca, at harbingermedianetwork.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. You've been listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. This episode is brought to you by Unrigged. Learn more about Canada's coalition of more than 30 progressive publishers and get all your independent Canadian journalism, including news, videos, and podcasts, in one place at unrigged.ca. And by The Alberta Advantage. Find the show's almost 9 years of archive episodes at albertaadvantagepod.com, at harbingermedianetwork.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at Harbinger Tweets and on Instagram at Media Harbinger, and now on Blue Sky for updates on new episodes, and subscribe to the Harbinger newsletter for a weekly Wednesday roundup from Canada's cross-country community of 83 socially and politically progressive podcasts. We'll be back with a new episode next week. Until then, I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
And Clause 4 says that a Labour government will secure for the workers by hand and brain the greatest possible control, etc., of the means of production and exchange, you know, production, distribution, and exchange. And I think it's very, very symptomatic that it says will secure for the workers. And there are similar phrases in the Regina Manifesto as well, right? Even when they're talking about, you know, public ownership and talking about the transition to socialism, there's really a lack of the conception that working class people can, you know, can think and can act politically in ways that are not just, you know, voting for us, and can liberate themselves and build a new society. And that's something that, you know, is one of the, you know, to me, a really fundamental belief.
Bird note. It's late summer in Canada, and this Swainson's hawk is about to embark on an astonishing journey. Every year, they travel 12,000 miles round trip between their grassland breeding grounds in western North America and their wintering territories in the Pampas Plains of Argentina. During fall migration, Swainson's hawks form massive flocks with other migratory raptors, sometimes numbering in the tens of thousands, creating a river of raptors that flow from southern Mexico to Panama and beyond. Swainson's hawks are related to red-tailed hawks, but they are more slender, about the size of a mallard duck, and have long, pointed wings that span nearly 4 feet. Though they mostly hunt small mammals in the summer, Swainson's hawks feast almost exclusively on insects like grasshoppers and locusts while in South America. That's actually what gives them their name in Argentina, aguilucho langostero, or grasshopper hawks. These beautiful birds have hunted bugs for millennia, but recent agricultural practices have put them both at risk. In the 1990s, pesticides in Argentina killed over 20,000 Swainson hawks in just 2 years. The tragedy propelled scientists from the US and Argentina to join forces. They banned the pesticide, preventing more deaths and gradually allowing bird populations to recover. The more than 800,000 Swainson hawks now soaring across the Americas are living proof that when we choose to act, we can make a difference. For Bird Note, I'm Shaky Espejo.
Hey, are you okay? It's okay not to be okay. Kids Help Phone is available 24/7, so you don't have to deal with your feelings alone. You can text with a volunteer crisis responder or call a professional counselor. Visit kidshelpphone.ca.